Technical Solutions. It's time for Fed Talk, the live show for Feds in the know. From federal agencies to Capitol Hill, the attorneys of Shaw, Bransford, and Roth bring in experts from across the federal community to bring you inside the issues. Fed Talk is meant to provide general information about legal issues. However, the views expressed in this program are not intended to provide legal counseling. Listeners are cautioned not to rely upon any statements made in resolving legal issues they may face, but instead to consult with their own attorney about specific situations. Attorneys are not engaged in providing legal services while appearing on the program and are not responsible in any manner for the consequences that may stem directly or indirectly from reliance on any statement made during this program.
Good morning and welcome to Fed Talk. I'm Deborah Roth and I'm here in the studio this morning with Mark Pearl, who is the president and CEO of Homeland Security and Defense Business Council. And I'll be speaking with Mark this morning on the whole issue sort of arisen out of the Washington Post three-part series, Top Secret America, particularly the one-day series that was titled National Security Incorporated. We're very pleased and lucky to have Mark with us in the studio this morning. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning, Deborah. Good to be with you.
And, you know, contracting, the whole idea of contracting out in the government has been off and on, up and down, ebbing and flowing, not just this administration, prior administration, and even, you know, in the Clinton administration. You know, it's the pendulum. It swings back and forth. I don't know how you describe it. It ebbs and flows. But we're very fortunate to have you here representing your organization, particularly as the post has sort of shed light on this issue. And Mark, as I said, is president and CEO of the Homeland Security and Defense Business Council. And I'm going to let Mark explain his background, but you have a little bit experience both in the private sector and in government, like Right. Most people in this town. And, you know, I thought it'd be interesting for our listeners to hear a little bit about your experience and how you ended up at the council.
Well, it's a good question. First of all, it's not just this Post article. We had a policy letter on what is inherently governmental that was that had to have responses to in June. There was a memorandum in March of last year that
the president
issued with regard to federal contracting and what's going on. So you're right. It's part of a cycle that's been going on. I've been in Washington, I don't know if that's fortunately or unfortunately, for 30 years now.
Right. I'm just right behind you on that one.
Right. And I learned very early on when I met somebody when I first came here who had come in with the Kennedy administration in 1980. And I said, so do you feel like you're a resident? He said, it took about 20 years, but I do now.
No, so That's what they say. I just saw that a couple of months ago. I think I read it in the Post. There was an article on what makes you, you know, a true Washingtonian, because so many of us are transplants. And you had to live and work in the city for 20 years.
That's it.
And I made it.
Well, and I've now 30. So the context of my being in Washington is important as we lead to where we are today, because over the course of certainly from 1980 towards the end, right at the end of the Carter administration going into the Reagan administration, there has always been this kind of debate in terms of how does government work best? Under what circumstances? How do you use the expertise, the innovation that exists that doesn't necessarily reside in the government, mm-hmm. but resides in people who are either providing to the government or used to be in the public service? During that time, I've led public service, public interest groups. I've been on the Hill. I was chief of staff for a number of members and legislative counsel. I learned as a policy wonk, as the case would be in certainly in the 90s, what it meant to turn the internet from a small I to a capital I in terms of what information technology could bring to the American public, and then ran my own firm. And 2.5 years ago, it came to the council. The context of that cycle for myself was that I realized that the collaboration, coordination, communication, the kind of alliterative C's, as it were, was absolutely necessary for us to not lose sight of mission. Mm-hmm. And I think that this debate
government mission.
The mission of government to achieve the health, welfare, and safety. And in the context of what we're talking about today and what I do now is the focus on safety and security. If all of these debates turn away from the context of what is what we're trying to achieve in terms of mission, mm-hmm. lose sight of that, ignore that, mm-hmm. then I think that we've lost a tremendous opportunity to really do what the American public needs. And in the context of intelligence, as this the series is, or in my work on a day-to-day basis, homeland security, mm-hmm. Then I think we would it would be a very difficult row to hoe if we ignore that to our peril.
And you know, and when I think about the tension that's out there currently between the what work gets done, government work gets done by a government employee, an appointed government official, or civil servant, versus what work gets done by a contractor, I see it as decades of, you know, if you ever read the book The Tipping Point, mm-hmm. or read excerpts of it, it's these decades of trends and events that all of a sudden collide and you have a tipping point. The government never built submarines and warships. You know, they didn't actually manufacture them. That's what private companies did. But as the world got more complicated and as people lived longer and wanted to work longer, and it's a function of the government, they become eligible for retirement. No, people still want to work. And clearly the events post 9/11 gave the government a very large worldwide mission, needed a lot of brains, a lot of talent, a lot of manpower, a lot of technology. And I think it all comes together. And I wasn't necessarily surprised with the number of companies or people engaged in the effort, because the effort's very big and it's very worldwide. And there's a lot of talent. And I've had people on the show talking about, like I said, during the course of several administrations, as world events change, we've had people and the policy of the government changes on who you contract out, what gets contracted out, what doesn't. You know, I've had people in groups on the show talking about the policy issues behind it, you know, the interests it serves. And it really is a combination of worldwide events, policy of the government, where are we going to be, what are we going to do, and the amount of capital, you know, both human capital, right. and technology, you know, product, goods and service capital you need. And, you know, the government's got a big mission, and I'm not surprised. So I've always heard everybody, no matter what side of the issue they're on, they all talk about, if you don't have a coordinated, cooperative effort between the government that has the mission and the contracting world, it won't succeed. You need both. Everybody seems to agree on that.
Well, they do agree on it in the when you get into the details, or right. if you stay at 50,000 feet. It's in between when we try to sort these things out. The cycle that you were talking about at the beginning, this has gone on for 90 years, since the 1920s. The whole nature of how are we going to, in the Roosevelt administration, provide for, you know, the CCC and bring everybody, you know, on board as kind of government workers. But when you look at things like the space program or the Erie Canal or the Transcontinental Railway or the, the interstate highway, you know, the nature of these complicated projects that are not going to last forever need expertise, need innovation, need creativity, need research and development that the government cannot necessarily keep, you know, to the side and always have. Move to today. Mm-hmm. The government was not going to have a pre-positioning of equipment to handle a potential oil spill in the Gulf.
Right.
That was going to have to be, in essence, provided by the private sector in every way, shape, and form, whether it was third parties or BP or, you know, anybody, Transocean. The context is, who provides the oversight, the decisions, the control, mm-hmm. over that kind of use, as well as the product, the technology, the services, the personnel? And if we recognize that, then whether it's in the intelligence community, mm-hmm. along the lines of what the Post was talking about, or whether it's along the definition of what is inherently governmental in terms of the policy letter, if we lose sight of that, of who has control and oversight.
And who gets to make the decision.
Right. Then, if we lose sight of that, then we absolutely should have a debate. But certainly, my experience in the contracting community and contractors, because there's a difference between contracts and contractors. There are contracts that are out there extensively, and the Post talks about the number of contracts. Those aren't necessarily always involved contractors. And so we have to make that differentiation. But the fact is that if we lose sight of that, then in point of fact, we will lose sight of what our ultimate mission is.
And, you know, Mark, eventually we are going to talk about the president's memo back in March of 2009 and then Office of Federal Procurement Policy's request for comments on a regulation that really gets us to the heart. That's the heart of the issue.
Exactly.
And we've thrown that term around, what is inherently governmental, but we're going to talk about that later in the show because it's really, you know, when you're inside the Beltway, we all sort of feel like we know what we're talking about, but we need to explain it to our listeners. We do need to take our first break. I wanted to remind our listeners that our show is brought to you, Fed Talk is brought to you by GEICO, where 15 minutes could save you 15% on car insurance. For more information about GEICO, the World Wide Web, geico.com. You are listening to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
And now, a word from our good friends at GEICO, where you could save 15% on car insurance. When you say that you work for the federal government, many people out there immediately picture you wearing a suit, driving a government-issue sedan, and living in D.C. While that may be true for some, in reality, federal employees have a wider variety of jobs than most people could ever imagine, from postal workers to CIA agents, from working in an office to working in outer space. These jobs are all so different that it's hard to believe they have something in common, but they do. And that similarity is GEICO. As employees of the federal government, many of these people may be eligible for additional discounts on top of GEICO's already low rates. And just because the cost is lower doesn't mean that GEICO's service is anything less than top rate. So whether you're in animal control or air traffic control, call GEICO at 1-800-947-AUTO. Or go online to geico.com and find out how much you could save.
Welcome back to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Deborah Roth, and I'm here today in the studio with Mark Pearl. He is the president and CEO of the Homeland Security and Defense Business Council. If you have a question or a comment for Mark, give us a call toll-free, 1-877-936-9333, or you can email your question to us or comment to fedtalk@federalnewsradio.com. So, Mark, I've mentioned several times now the name of your council that you are the president and CEO of, and, you know, we should tell your listeners the website. They can go check it out. But what is the council? How did it get established? What do they do? How are they connected to the contractor community?
Well, in every way, shape, and form, thank you for asking. The council was in essence formed because of the impetus of what took place on 9/11, obviously. There was a need to stand up a new agency. I mean, the first new agency probably since we formed the Department of Defense. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Department of Education was simply kind of pulled out of the existing HEW.
Right. And
in the formation of this, there had never been anybody who had been at, quote unquote, the Department of Homeland Security. So there are brand new federal employees. Things like the TSA had to be stood up, brand new agency. So the private sector came in and was providing services. Many of the contractors, many of the largest at the time, Department of Energy contractors, Department of Defense contractors, et cetera, were providing their services, their technology, their products as solution providers to achieve the department. In the context of that, the senior executives came together and realized that there was no strategy. This was being formed like a whack-a-mole. You know, we were responding to the events of 9/11, a couple days later to the anthrax, et cetera, and we were always kind of running on a treadmill. So the private sector, realizing that there needed to be substantive engagement of senior executives at both the public sector and the private sector, government and industry, wanted to come together to provide a safe environment so that there could be this engagement, this dialogue, this conversation, separate and apart from contracts, separate and apart from program projects, et cetera. But how can we achieve mission in the best possible way?
And you know, the background, because I'm thinking this, and I feel like, you know, for our listeners who might not have been cognizant at the time that Homeland was created and stood up, it was created by an act of Congress. It created the basic structure. It said there will exist a Department of Homeland Security. It pulled, I believe, 33 existing agencies.
Well, 22 agencies.
22 existing agencies from other parts of the government. It pulled them into the Department of Homeland Security. When you look at the creation, the statute, us lawyers, we call it the organic statute. When you look at the organic statute, it's a very bare bones structure. This is who you are. This is what you'll do. And then it was the task of the executive branch, the president, to take this overall mission that never existed, along with 22 agencies that had their own separate missions that were focused slightly different pre 9/11.
Different cultures
pre 9/11, and they lumped them together. And it, to me, to sit at the sidelines, because I had clients in all these agencies, and watch it happen, I knew I was watching history. And it's interesting because I never thought about the filling in the gaps, what you're talking about. Because Congress created this big structure, but you sort of just imagine that, oh, it'll work out, you know, through the kinks. Like any family relations, you get together, it works out.
And at first it becomes a dysfunctional family, too.
And so what you're saying, that's right. And so what you're saying is that people had the foresight at the time and figured, well, we actually really need to maybe have a plan, think it through.
Exactly. And even to this day, the strategies surrounding long-term mission are still being worked out. We're dealing with, in many respects, a seven-year-old, you know, adolescent. And we cannot, in our fast food, MTV, get it now kind of mentality, have everything fixed right away. This is an ever-evolving, ever-dynamic agency. It's an ever-evolving, ever-dynamic marketplace. Mm-hmm. Our organization wanted to bring together the senior executives to be the voice of the private sector of industry to, in essence, substantively engage on the innovation, the expertise, and the capabilities of Homeland Security solution providers. And that's an important phrase. In discussions that we had with former Secretary Ridge and former Secretary mm-hmm. Chertoff, mm-hmm. one of the things that they kept telling us was that when they were the Secretary of the Department, companies would come to them all the time and said, I have the greatest whiz-bang, you know, greatest, you know, product service that you could imagine.
This will solve everything.
It'll solve everything. It's the, you know, it's the Holy Grail. One of the things that we had discussions with both towards the end of their terms, because they kind of began to get it, and when they left, mm-hmm. and now providing consultation on their own, is that they wanted to understand and have a discussion surrounding solutions. And so that's what the council has been, in essence, focused on over the course of its six-year history, which is how can we engage to, in essence, be in dialogue in a safe, not to try to sell something, but how do we try to strategically discuss and engage the public sector with the innovations, the expertise, and the capabilities that exist in the private sector to come up with solutions toward mission success. And that is, so a subset of that goes into the broader, into the narrower component part of what we're talking about today, which is then what is the role of mm-hmm. industry in providing toward that mission? And so the work that the council does in programs, in projects, in bringing together white papers and podcasts and presentations of our members, we have the leading members of solution providers. Our members are the leading solution providers in the Homeland Security arena. We don't have companies that want to be in the Homeland Security arena. They're the only members of the business council are folks that have contracts. We probably represent the members that have about 2/3 of all of the contracts in the Homeland Security arena. And that's with a small H and small S. It's not at just DHS. It's at HHS in mm-hmm. pandemic. It's at DOJ. It's at Department of Energy. It's at the state and local level. It's at the global level. So when we're talking security and safety in a domestic sense, we're not the defense business council. It's Homeland Defense was the context. Because we don't really know how it was going to be. So the context is, how can we in the industry be of greater value to mission, and through that, obviously, to the Department of Homeland Security and other agencies to achieve that kind of goal and mission that we all need in this country.
Now, before our show, before we aired, Mark and I had a conversation off camera, off mic, and you said, and I think this is an important point, we're more like a think tank, not a lobbying organization.
Well, I think we're somewhere between that.
Yeah, in this town, you know, you have that name, people just go, oh, he's a lobbyist.
Right. We are not a lobbyist. We have, in fact, we advocate on behalf of and the voice of the private sector, but we're not a lobbying organization. We're not a trade association that has 600 or 700 or 800 or 1,000 or 5,000 members. We only have 50 members. They belong to a number of different other trade associations. And we're not trying to, out of whole cloth, compete with a Heritage or a Center for American Progress or a Cato. They're doing high-level think tank work. But the difference of many of the think tanks...
You're a little of everything.
We're somewhere in, we fill the gaps. I mean, you said that a couple minutes ago in terms of the Swiss cheese. We're not trying to do program development. We're not trying to advocate on behalf of individual contracts. We never get involved in those kinds of things. On the same token, we're not going to stay at the high-level White Tower approach, mm-hmm. which has no necessarily basis in reality for what industry needs.
Application.
And application right. in the real world. So business councils, and there are many business councils that are more narrow in their focus, are around Washington and provide that kind of, what I want to say, safe environment so that the industry and government leading senior executives can come together in an intimate, safe setting to talk about, dialogue, and strategize for what the country needs to become safer and more secure.
And the dialogue is senior executives from the government agencies with the issues, the problems, the needs, talking to the industry where they might find the innovative solutions. And it's like, here's our issues, here's our needs, here's our problems. What can you, and it's meant to be a dialogue, not an actual, you know, opportunity to sell a good or service.
Exactly. I mean, we just had, for example, everybody is talking about post December 25th,
yeah.
a new aviation security issue.
Right.
And let's put in scanners in every airport, or let's put in biodetection or whatever it might be. We didn't want this to focus just on technology. So we just had a couple of weeks ago a major dialogue with DHS officials, the director of research, the director of global operations for TSA, the first CIO of TSA, as a matter of fact, along with the leading staffer on Senator Lieberman at the Homeland Security and Government Affairs Committee, talking about the holistic approach to aviation security, that it includes obviously technology, but it includes intelligence, it includes personnel, it includes the whole nature. The nature of what the council is about is the holistic approach to our nation's safety and security.
So obviously people listening to they go, oh, there's, you know, it's a town of skeptics and cynics, people who have been on both sides, mm-hmm. you know, inside and outside in every branch of government. And they listen to you and they're like, skeptics and cynics, that's such nice talk. And it sounds so, you know, but he's really, you know, it's about in this town, it's always about access. And, and the Post, I thought it was very interesting because they presented it. You know, they do, it's very well presented in terms of this huge contractor force came from the federal government. It's very well presented that you see what people outside of D.C. call the revolving door. And yet what I thought was missing, the flavor that was missing, and I sort of feel that you're on the cusp of that, is that when you talk about the people who maybe are the actual human beings who work in these companies, who are on your council, they actually used to be feds. They actually used to be
many
in government. Many
yes.
of them. And I know these people. They used to be my clients, or they become my clients. And inside or outside of government, these people are extremely committed to the mission, to the overall mission of the government, and then where their area of expertise lies. You know, you're talking about people who spent 20, 30 years doing that thing on the inside. And it's very hard to walk away from any federal employees, to walk, you know, to retire and just walk away and then take up, you know, running a bait and tackle shop, you know, on the beat. It's hard. And so They continue to do it on the outside. And I thought that flavor was kind of missing. They actually really, the skepticism and cynicism that you hear, you always hear it in the background. It's the static in this town. Is that when you actually talk to a lot of these people, I mean, they're very, in the contracting world, they're very devoted to the mission. And it's not, because the article talks about the conflict of the bottom line in these companies, which, of course, it's America. People want to make money. But it's really, I think it's fascinating, this town. It's a lot about the bottom line in the contractor world, but it's also a lot about people who still want to do that work, and they want to really save lives, help people. And I find it, I think the contractor world post 9/11 is really it's so unique, because it's really filled with people who are definitely interested in making money, but they're very interested and committed still to the mission. And that, to me, when I read about your council, was like, oh, those are those people. I think those are the people who are in your council.
Well, and it's, but the beauty of the council, and
they're very interested in the solution.
In providing the solution. And that's an incredible point that you just made. The fact is that, and one differentiation from our community is that these people had never been in the Department of Homeland Security in many cases.
Right.
Because they hadn't
exist.
Cycled out. It didn't exist. And so they came from these wide variety of cultures. So the context is, how can they bring that to bear to make it work? Business folks in our community also have a way of, when you're starting a brand new business, the Department of Homeland Security, you need not just people who came from DOD and not just people who came from other agents, the other 21 agencies, et cetera, but came from business to help stand up and manage and provide the services to this brand new agency, which still doesn't have a headquarters building, which still doesn't have a common culture that everybody else might have. There is a Pentagon. There is a national headquarters for the VA or for
the Department of Justice,
DOJ. We know where it is. Right. When you ask, where is the Department of Homeland Security? In essence, it is an interesting response. It either can be negative, that it doesn't have a headquarters, or it can be positive, that it's in all of us. The whole nature of what it is about preparedness in this country, that every United States citizen, unlike one who's in uniform and has to fight overseas, every United States citizen, and that's part of the mission, has to be imbued with the sense that they are part of the solution as well. And that's the conduit that the council plays as well, that we play not only to the government, but to the broader community at large, that preparedness is a watchword, not just as we come up on the 10th anniversary in a year on 9/11. The council is focused not on 9/11. The council is focused on the 10th anniversary of September 10th. And by that, we mean the following. We don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. We don't know whether it's going to be a pandemic, H1N1. We don't know whether it's going to be an oil spill. We don't know whether it's going to be a terrorist attack. We don't know what it's going to be. Are we prepared? Are we better prepared than we were 10 years ago to confront that? And that's not just about the Department of Homeland Security or the contractor community. It's about every single one of Americans who have an investment in that success and that outcome.
Interesting dialogue. Mark, we have to take our mid-show break and stop here. You're listening to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
And now, a word from our good friends at GEICO, where you could save 15% on car insurance. By now, you've no doubt seen those car insurance commercials with the talking gecko on TV. He's always talking about how people could save 15% or more switching to GEICO. Well, that sounds like a pretty good deal in and of itself. But get this, if you're an employee of the federal government, you may be eligible to save even more than that. That's something the Gecko didn't mention in all those commercials. And you've probably heard many times about how many people have switched to Geico. Millions. But what you might not know is how many people stay with Geico once they've switched. In fact, on average, Geico customers who are federal employees have stayed with the company for over 20 years. Now that's customer satisfaction. Sound like a good deal to you? Then just call GEICO at 1-800-947-AUTO or go online to geico.com and find out how much you could save.
I'm Bill Bransford, host of Fed Talk and partner at the law firm of Shaw, Bransford & Roth. Fed Talk brings you inside information on hot topics in the federal community. From the halls of Congress to federal agencies, get the latest on the laws, regulations, and activities that directly impact federal employees. Tune into Fed Talk on Federal News Radio 1500 AM as we bring in the experts to bring you inside the issues.
Welcome back to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. I'm Deborah Roth, and I'm here with Mark Pearl, who is the president and CEO of the Homeland Security. And I always get it wrong. I forget the defense, the Homeland Security
and Defense Business Council.
And if you've been listening to our show, you know that Mark has been both on the inside and outside of government his entire career, 30 years in this town. And we're having a conversation that was precipitated by the Washington Post series either last week or the week before. In particular, the series was called Top Secret America. One of the days was a whole series on National Security Incorporated, where the Post highlighted the amount of national security work that's being performed for the government by the private sector. And, of course, it's sort of shed light on the never-ending debate about what's the work of the government, what's the work of the private sector, what goods and services are something that the government itself should actually do and provide versus the private sector. And if you were listening at the beginning of the show, then I think either Mark or I used the phrase inherently governmental. That's a phrase, Mark, that comes from the FAR, the Federal Acquisition
Regs.
Regulations. And back in the Bush administration, there was a lot of angst by federal employees that a lot was being contracted out. Unions felt a lot that was being contracted out was inherently governmental. And as you said, Mark, Obama, when he came in, he issued that letter in March 2009, sort of shedding light on, what exactly, let's think about this very carefully, because so much of what the government's doing now with its world, we have this worldwide reach, let's rethink that. It may be cycling back. And Office of Federal Procurement Policy back in, I guess it was March of 2010, issued a proposed policy letter.
Right.
And asked people to comment on, here are the concerns raised by contracting out, and here are some of the proposed policy fixes. And it focuses on that phrase, inherently governmental. And I know your counsel responded.
Yes, we did. I want to put, if I can, Deborah, just put it a little bit into context, because we tend to go back only a few years. If people have any kind of a memory, in 1993, there was a reinventing government initiative.
I remember the reinvention of government.
That Vice President Gore led. Mm-hmm. As a result of that initiative, which was, in essence, looking at how many people were in government, and at the time, there was a sense that it was over bloated at that point.
It's about the size it is now. It was about 2.1 million.
Right. 250,000 jobs were shed. $40 billion were realized in savings. And in point of fact, that was a good thing at that time, that we were outsourcing things that were not necessarily needed to be pre-positioned or within government. That trend continued, obviously, to try to slim down the amount of government and to squash down the budget, the federal budget. I mean, that's the state that we're in right now. So President Bush continued that process, but also he continued it because of the events of 9/11, because of the need for immediate, unique expertise. We needed outside help. We couldn't do it only within the existing governmental employee framework. So now we move into a situation in 2009 and 2010 where we're confronting, not from a political standpoint, because obviously it was started under a Democratic administration this cycle, but because of budget situations, because of the crisis, whether it be in the Gulf or whether it be in Afghanistan or whether it be in our own homeland, there is, how do we solve the problem? And that led to, we should do it in-house. We should insource as opposed to outsource. My boss at the Information Technology Association of America, when I was general counsel 12, 13 years ago, use the phrase co-sourcing. And I think that many respects, this policy letter misses the point of what that says. It should not be about we automatically say everybody should be, we default to everybody being a government worker, and then you prove me wrong that it should then be done in an outsourcing way.
A-136, that was sort of, is that the right, did we get the right OMB circular? That's sort of, it was the Bush administration, it sort of had the same thing. It was a competition, prove who, you know, prove who is best suited, federal employee, federal workforce versus the contractor workforce, prove who is going to be the most efficient,
most effective
and achieve success. Yeah, they sort of competed it that way.
And that, it is not, and so, I'm not necessarily about competition, but I'm about, as I said at the beginning, at the top of the show, if there is control, if there is oversight, then of the government employee, then we can make a decision strategically, economically, technologically. You know, I used to use the phrases when I used to testify on the Hill. Three phrases I think are important that we don't use. One is, what are the unintended consequences of whatever action we take? Do we ask those questions? Congress doesn't always ask it. The federal government doesn't ask it. Is it technologically feasible to provide that? And is it economically reasonable? If we ask those three questions
feasible
going
reasonable.
In,
okay.
If we use those three questions, then in point of fact, it's not a question of competition. It's a question of how do we achieve mission? As long as, and I'll go back to the, as long as we understand that command, control, and oversight resides only in, solely in, and our community supports that wholeheartedly, which is why we supported that context of the letter that said that what is
that.
Inherently fun, you know, governmental should remain that way. What we had the problem with was Appendix B of that letter, which in essence gave with the one hand and then took away with the other. If you default to everything being an inherently governmental, whether it be the building of a building or providing technical support, et cetera, you cannot always provide those kind of unique or short-term services with government employees. It's not cost efficient. It doesn't achieve the mission. And you're now holding on to people. It certainly limits your flexibility. Those are the things that we talked
about. That's when you said your former boss, your prior employer, talked about co-sourcing.
Right.
So by co-sourcing, he was talking about there are things that the government should clearly perform.
Exactly.
And there are things that the government may not be best situated to perform. Maybe we should think of the private sector. But don't you think most Americans buy into that?
I think that when it's explained that way, absolutely. But if, and it would be the only thing, and you alluded to this, that the only thing that the Post story talks about, or even the tenor and tone of the policy letter, which we had problems with, that the tone of the letter was adversarial, that in point of fact, you should automatically almost, it could be interpreted that you mandate that it always be a governmental in-source work. And if that's the way it's going to be, you're never going to, in essence, for fear of pissing off your boss, you're never going to outsource a project. You're never going to outsource a solution. That's the tone as well as the interpretation of the letter, of the proposed letter, was what gave us pause. And that's what we commented on in a very simple way. Let's keep the narrow definition. We support that. Let's try to urge and always think about inherently governmental, but only under the context of command, control, oversight. And then after that, we can make the decision for what's best for the country.
You know, your letter, you missed one other thing that, because I read your response. There was one other thing that your response did comment on. And when you think about this behemoth thing, the executive branch, because this time we say the federal government, we all talk in, you know, we know we're talking with each other. We know that when we say the federal government, we mean the executive branch. OK, well, the federal government actually is three branches of government. Here's your history lesson or your politics lesson for the day. But there's three branches of government. The one branch of government that probably, you know, consumes the most amount of money is the executive branch, the implementer of congressional policy and intent, the direction of the country. And it is a behemoth. It is a behemoth. One other, particularly post 9/11, and even under the Bush administration, it was a behemoth. And I love, you know, this whole small government, stay out of my lives. You know, under the Bush administration, it had no choice. It had to grow. I mean, how to protect the homeland. That was right. That was a very clear message sent to that administration, is keep us safe. Well, you know, welcome to more bodies and more work. And that costs money. But one other thing your letter did say was, in this huge behemoth of executive branch government and implementation of congressional will, let's find consistency. And I think about the number of federal agencies, the number of federal employees, the number of federal programs. When you think about, because you're looking for predictability, both inside and outside of government, clearly the business world thrives on predictability.
And certainty.
And business certainty. Most Americans can appreciate that when they look back in 2009, when the economy was so unpredictable, how the domino effect of how it affected almost every arena in the economy, where businesses were getting skittish. There was no predictability about money availability, business, you know, consumerism. And so the economy really was crippled by this lack of predictability. So I understand, and I respect in capitalism that you would be looking for predictability. I get that. Okay. But also the government is looking in some ways for predictability. It's going to hire a contractor. It needs a job done. It's looking to make sure it can get done right, on schedule, on budget. And when you think about this phrase, inherently governmental, and you shoot it across, you know, I don't know how many federal agencies there are. I don't know how many programs there are. And you're like, well, let's keep a consistent so that all the agencies, everyone in the business world sort of understands the essence of what is inherently governmental.
Right. What are the ground rules? What's the foundation on which you can build a successful mission?
And you commented on that and you said, well, let's make it consistent. And I think, well, how are they ever going to do that? And I'm waiting to see. I'm waiting to see what the office, I think it's a wise goal. I wonder if it's achievable.
It's a laudable goal, but I think I would only say this, Deborah, and this is the context. I go back to the Clinton administration's viewpoint of the economy. KISS, keep it simple, stupid.
Uh-huh.
To a great extent, we build on of a common foundation. I can't speak to what my counterparts in HHS or my counterpart organizations at Labor or Interior are saying, but I think that they're saying the same thing, which is we need a sense of consistency for this definition. We, unfortunately, at Homeland Security, don't have even the consistency in mission yet. We talked about the 22 agencies that are trying to come together. Our organization, as vertical as it sounds, which is only Homeland Security, has a very horizontal mission, from supply chain to counterterrorism to information sharing to cybersecurity and border security, cargo security, aviation security. We're all over the place. Our members can provide support for that mission, but we have to have some semblance of predictability, long-range planning, mm-hmm. business certainty. And that's why we kept our message in response to the letter.
It was very simple.
Very simple. Because we wanted to just simply say, we can get it right. We can provide it. Our folks want to provide success. It is not inherently we're not in the business of just winning one contract, getting our money and walking mm-hmm. away.
Profiteering and then walking
it's
away.
Not it.
That's not a business model.
Our guys make it because they have consistent, ongoing, long-term contracts because they've hit mission success.
Yeah. I have so much more that I want to throw out there and see how you respond, but we're running behind on the last break of our show. We do need to hear from our sponsor. You're listening to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
And now, a word from our good friends at GEICO, where you could save 15% on car insurance. When you say that you work for the federal government, many people out there immediately picture you wearing a suit, driving a government-issue sedan, and living in D.C. While that may be true for some, in reality, federal employees have a wider variety of jobs than most people could ever imagine, from postal workers to CIA agents, from working in an office to working in outer space. These jobs are all so different that it's hard to believe they have something in common, but they do. And that similarity is GEICO. As employees of the federal government, many of these people may be eligible for additional discounts on top of GEICO's already low rates. And just because the cost is lower doesn't mean that GEICO's service is anything less than top rate. So whether you're in animal control or air traffic control, call GEICO at 1-800-947-AUTO. Or go online to GEICO.com and find out how much you could save.
Welcome back to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. We're in the last segment of our show. I'm Deborah Roth. I'm here hosting Fed Talk this morning. My guest is Mark Pearl, who is the president and CEO of Homeland Security and Defense Business Council. You know, Mark, I did not give you the opportunity to put your organization's website out there. So for the listeners, I'm sure they could they've already Googled it or whatever it is.
It's very simple. It's homelandcouncil.org. All one word, Homeland Council. You can learn about the work that we've been doing, the papers that we've submitted. But most importantly, and I do want to point this out, we have a thing called a digital library. And in the digital library, we've collected, because the internet has a tendency to kind of whatever's the fast, newest thing and everything else gets pushed to the bottom. We get all of the kind of thought leadership and intellectual capital that our members have put forward, collect that into a compendium under topic headings like cyber, like information sharing. So the work that we're doing is not just the holding of programs and dialogues, but to promote, hopefully for those people who still read or listen to podcasts and whatnot, an opportunity to really learn more about what we're trying to accomplish.
So here's my response back to what you said about sort of what you felt was the I think you said adversarial, confrontational
tone
of the policy letter. And my response back is that, and of course we only have 8 minutes and I have so much more that I want to talk with you about. But my response back is that because we had the unions on during the whole Bush administration, but I'm going to go back even further. I'm going to go back to reinventing government. Because while you said that the whole point of reinventing government was to push down the numbers of federal employees that got bloated, get rid of what you didn't need, you know, a lot of people, Mark, they look back upon how government was reinvented, and the criticism is that if there was some, when the downsizing occurred, that in many places it occurred simply by offering people who had the years in service eligibility in, it lacked an overall view of picking programs and offices that maybe shouldn't have been touched versus programs and offices where we know we have too much of this. And it seemed like not a grand plan or other than age and service eligibility would reduce the government.
Right.
And David Walker, who everybody who listens to our show knows, he's been on several times. He was the head of GAO. He was the first to say it. He said it while it was happening. I don't feel like you people are actually thinking about where to cut. And it's just, you know, offering anyone who's got years and, you know, the retirement eligibility. And about a decade later, the government did feel in some offices and many offices across government that talent was gone and that they were sort of left bare bones and they were struggling mm-hmm. in those offices. So I'm not necessarily, you know, I think looking back, it was just about getting rid of numbers. I'm not sure it was a real overall look at what services does the government really not need to be in the business of performing. But the adversarialness, the federal employee felt during the Bush administration, they really felt like I forgot what the OMB circular number was, which right. said competed. They felt it was very adversarial and in their face.
Oh, there's no question.
And I think this is right. the other parties.
It's the cycle. It's the right. cycle going around. If we cut for the sake of cutting, if we bring in just for the sake of bringing in, if we now turn around in today and say everything has to be insourced just for the sake of doing it, we're not getting to the ultimate question that that's been in the undercurrent of what we've talked about, which is, what is the mission that you're trying to achieve?
It's sort of, when you look at the last 17 years, when you think about reinventing today, you look, it's like the standard. You're in this town long enough, you can get cynical. It's the standard bureaucratic response to, well, they did it that way, I'm going to do it this way, you know, do right. it just to do it. And, you know, I always, when people give that criticism, even though I'm not a federal employee, my business is all based upon federal employees, I said, you know what? It's really not fair. If you had to run an organization of 1.8 or 1.9 million people with all of the different missions they had domestically, worldwide, it's kind of hard to think it through and get it right all the time.
No, but you should take on the responsibility of spending part of your day, part of your week, part of your month, part of your year, whatever you can afford, to think a little bit more strategically. Back 17 years ago, back 8 years ago, and now. If, in fact, it's to assure in insourcing that there is no conflict of interest, that there's no mismanagement in the utilization or the oversight or the direction of federal funds, then we should have more inherently governmental jobs that are defined. There's no question about it. Mm-hmm. But if, in fact, the federal government is doing it just for the same reason that we did it 17 years ago, because we need to bring in more people into the government. It's not about a politics, and it shouldn't be just about economics.
Which
it's
the Post article makes the point. Yeah, the Post article makes the point that when they were outsourcing during the Bush administration, the belief was, and then day two of the series, you know, hammers that point home, that they got it wrong, that outsourcing was going to save the government money because contractors are cheaper than federal employees. Turns out, the Post says, I'm not sure how they empirically know it, but it turns out they say it's wrong, that it turned out it was more expensive.
In some cases, it might be more expensive in the short run. But in point of fact, if you bring somebody on as a federal employee for a unique project, for a particular project, if we brought on all of these employees just to handle the oil spill, now they're government employees. We have pensions, we have benefits, and are they going to sit around for 20 years waiting for the next oil spill? So we have to be strategic, and that's all that we are looking for. That you shouldn't have a tenor and tone for or against anybody. It should be neutral, fair, transparent, and leading to the same result, which is, in our case, in Homeland Security and in the intelligence community, what is the mission that we're trying to solve? What are we trying to achieve? And that is to keep America safer and more secure. And that's what the council's mission is about. That's what our members' mission is about. And to a great extent, we're losing sight of that sometimes when we get into the weeds of how many contractors do you have, or how many contractors have you paid for? That's what we're trying to achieve.
And, you know, I did ask you this before the show. I think it's important that you have the opportunity to say it on air. Your reaction to the Post, particularly the second day series, which was National Security Incorporated, your reaction sitting as the president and CEO of the council, what was your reaction to it? I liked it. I thought it was it showed a lot of wisdom.
Well, I think that the reaction is that we absolutely need sunshine is the best disinfectant. Though many of the pieces and many of the kind of facts and insights that the three-part piece did were, for those of us who are quote-unquote inside, knew about it.
Yeah.
We knew generally what was going on. We know generally what the arguments are. We know what those are. It's important to get that out to the public. There's no question about it. Was there anything new that we didn't know? Absolutely not. But what we're but that's part of the transparency that I'm talking about.
We need pieces like that. Because not all Americans are inside,
right,
connected to it.
We need this.
Absolutely.
And for the same token, we need the opposite viewpoint as well. We need, and that's what the council does. It's not just about one point of view. In fact, there is no one member of the council that has one particular point of view on anything. We are trying to bring together a spectrum of points of view so that the dialogue between industry and government can remain as in the same way as this article, as open as possible.
Yeah. And I think that is a very wise view. And Mark, I want to thank you for coming on our show, giving me the opportunity to have someone to talk to about the Post series. And I'm hoping that the Business Council will be back on maybe next year And we'll do it all over.
It was great to be with you.
Thank you.
Thank you.